and welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Sarah Adams-Shawn, an associate professor at the University of Arkansas Little Rock William H. Boehm School of Law, talks with Dorinda about her research on climate resilience and the law. Adams-Shawn was on campus in March of 2018 as part of the law school's speaker exchange.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the University of Arkansas.
Thank you.
So you've been here today to do part of our speaker exchange series. And the topic was Beyond Localism, Harnessing State Adaptation Lawmaking to Help Local Governments Increase Climate Resistance. Tell us about it.
All right. So it's a work in progress, my research is really focused on how to help local governments create communities that are more resilient to climate risks. And in my research, what I've seen is that local governments have already tools that are really powerful for increasing resilience of a community to risks like flooding, heat wave, drought, because they have control over so much of the decisions regarding land use and infrastructure and patterns of development. However, they face all sorts of obstacles to doing that. To exercising, you know, that authority that they have in a way that really increases resilience. And so I ask in my paper, and I asked at my talk today, the question, and then I try to answer it, how might state governments help them? You know, what things could we do at the state level, at state lawmaking level, so that local governments can get over some of those impediments and really create more resilient communities? Because what we're seeing is already a level of risk that's not acceptable, mm-hmm. and it's only going to get worse.
Well, have you come up with any suggestions for state government?
Yeah. So, yes. I don't just ask. I also ask an answer. Although some of it is still, you know, I'm still really thinking it through. It's a complex question.
Yeah. Because like you said in your talk, it's not just floods. It's fire and tornado and goodness knows what else. There are any number of natural disasters.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're seeing with increasing average global temperatures and with sea level rise is increased incidence of severe weather, more extreme weather variability. So oftentimes you'll hear people say, well, we had a cold winter. It must not be getting warmer. But actually, a more extreme cold winter can be a consequence of the increased global average temperatures because it's just another sign of that extreme variability. So we could even be seeing just more severe ice storms, too, for example.
Okay.
One of the things that I really focus on is that there are certain areas where it would be beneficial for us to move out of the area or to de-intensify how we use an area. So instead of having, you know, a really packed subdivision with a school and a library and a hospital, we might say, oh, look, if we take projections for the next 40 years, we'll see that this area is going to be under more increased wildfire risk or more increased flood risk over time. Let's consider putting less intense and less vulnerable uses there. Maybe not a hospital, maybe not a school, maybe not the seat of local government. You know, I looked at one town where after a flood in New York, the entire seat of local government, as well as all of their first responders, were flooded.
Oh, no.
Yeah. As well, and their ability to even print off their payroll. This dates it a little bit because now most of that's done electronically. But they couldn't get to any of that. And one of the city managers had gone in and gotten a printer and taken it to higher ground and was like printing off paychecks to pay people to work overtime to deal with this disaster. You know, and so just thinking about, you know, maybe we won't stop using the land entirely, but making land use decisions to put less critical uses in such vulnerable areas. But you asked, what are some of the things that state government can do? And in my talk, I focused on a New York law that's really the first in the country that does three things. And one is that it mandates that the state government provide climate risk projection data at the state level and update it every 5 years.
And that's not done now?
No, okay. It's not done now. There is a lot of data available at the national, international, and large regional level. But lots of times, local governments that are trying to assess risks related to weather and climate and changing risks over time struggle because the data isn't at scale for them.
Well,
they're just generalizing. Like, they'll say, well, the whole, you know, Southeast faces these kinds of risks. But does that mean Fayetteville faces those risks? Maybe, maybe not. Mm. And, you know, I think that local government policymakers, they don't want to just be guessing. It's already a political, you know, there's already a lot of political pressure around this topic to be accurate and to be credible, you know, and so I think they're really aware of that and they don't want to be guessing. Plus, they can't plan effectively without data that's at scale for them. So the New York law mandates that. It's a challenging mandate because the state player, you know, the state regulators have to come up with that data.
Yeah.
But there are sources and they're doing that. It also mandates at the state level the creation of a bunch of model local laws so that the local governments, which are really resource constrained, you know, they may not have an attorney or a planner that they can task with, will figure out how to do all this progressive planning. You know, they're busy with just their everyday, you know, necessities. And so the state government is preparing these model laws. And then it also includes a bunch of changes to state level permitting and funding decisions that require consideration of climate risk in order to get the permit or get the funds. So those are three of the things that that law does. You know, I think some of those are going to help local governments out more than others.
Yeah, that makes sense. It seems like it'd be a little daunting. Like you said, everyone has stuff they're already doing to task someone with this as well, or to hire someone new. I mean, local and state government is always strapped.
Right, exactly. And residents don't want to be paying more in taxes to fund things, especially, you know, if you're in areas of the country where maybe they don't perceive the risk as that acute or real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a lot of political capital in spending money on this. Or even if there's a political will to spend the money just isn't there.
Yeah.
So.
Makes sense. Well, how did you get interested in this? What led you down the path to study this particular subject?
Yeah, I have a background in environmental law, but I wasn't focused on climate, really on climate change law at all or resilience. But I moved to Long Island, New York for a faculty position at a law school. And right after I moved there, Hurricane Sandy hit, which some people call Superstorm Sandy. Either one is defensible. But and that... my law school was closed for must have been about 2 weeks. We were trapped in our neighborhood. Downed trees made it so you couldn't get out of either end of the street for many days. We had no power for 10 days. Some of my neighbors had no power for 2 weeks. And we didn't have flooding in my neighborhood. We were high enough up, but many people, many of my students lost their homes, their cars, their possessions. And so soon after that, I started working. I just kind of shifted my research to looking at climate resilience and started working with the state and local governments on the issue.
How do you define resilience?
Yeah, I define resilience as, I don't have like a pat definition off the top of my head, but I define it as being able to withstand risk. So, and that's vague, so there's a huge, you know, spectrum of what that might mean. So maybe you have a building that's in a flood area. It gets flooded, but the ground floor has been floodproofed in such a way that it doesn't have to, after that, be gutted because of mold damage.
Okay.
So that would be one level of resilience. That building's flooded, and maybe during the period of the flood and shortly thereafter, people are trapped in the upper floors.
Mm-hmm.
So someone might say, well, that's not as resilient. You know, so there's risk tolerances, right?
Right.
So maybe you're okay as a community with putting a building there as long as it's not going to have to be gutted. It's going to survive the flood. Or maybe you decide, oh, we don't want to put that building there because we don't want people trapped in the upper floors. One of my colleagues at my former law school, her mother was trapped in the upper floor of a high-rise building in Queens after Sandy and was trying to get to a neighbor's apartment for help and fell down and broke her hip.
Oh, dear.
And, yeah, and had to be transported by boat to the hospital. Right?
Because it can't be fun.
Right? So even if that building had floodproofing at the ground floor, she may not have defined that as resilient.
Yeah.
You know? So, however, the building didn't have power, and she fell down in a dark stairwell.
Okay.
So maybe, you know, another level of resilience would have been achieved by somehow being able to keep the lights on in the building.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So along the same lines of what led you to this research, what led you to the law in general? What led you to law school?
That's a little different story.
That's
yeah.
Okay.
No, that's, let's see. Well, I have a master's in public policy. And after I got my master's in public policy, I worked in Portland, Oregon at the Metro Regional Government.
And your master's in public policy you got in London,
mm-hmm,
correct?
At the London School of Economics.
Okay.
Yeah, and while I was there, a lot of the people in my master's program were going straight from there to law school, and I said, I don't want to go to law school. but then after working in the regional government for a while, I just started to become more and more intrigued with going to law school. I think I was working with local law all the time. This isn't going to sound very lofty, but people told me I'd be good at it.
That's a good
I was
reason.
Young.
Yeah.
Those were the kinds of things that appealed to me. I also, and I find this to just be so strange, but it's completely true. I thought I wanted to become a law professor. And to this day, I'm like, how could I have known that? I hadn't even gone to law school. I hadn't studied law. But I was right.
Yeah.
Because I went to law school. I practiced law for about 10 years. And then I became a law professor, and I love being a law professor. So somehow this young 20 me who didn't know a thing was right about that.
So what got you from practicing into teaching?
Yeah, I practiced law in Portland, Oregon, and I taught a little bit as an adjunct at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. And I had always suspected I'd like it. I love teaching. I love working with people while they're learning.
Yeah.
And even when I practiced law, I was always the mentor to the junior attorneys. It was always my job. And even judges. There's a federal judge in Oregon who I appeared in front of. Everyone was always really intimidated by her. And she said to me, you're such an academic lawyer. And I was like, is that a compliment or a critique? I don't know. And she said, well, I said, so, she was like, you like to write a lot. but you're always very accurate and thorough. And okay, well, that's good. So anyway.
Yeah,
so
I take that as a compliment.
I took it as a compliment in the end. Yeah, I knew she wanted me to maybe write fewer pages. But I just kept kind of getting small affirmations that I really did want to shift into a full-time teaching career. And so then I finally decided to go for it.
That's great. So what about teaching do you really love? Is there something in particular or just generally?
I think on the day-to-day teaching side, I love working with people while they're learning, you know, and I love my kind of go-getter top student, you know, because of their just drive and enthusiasm. I also love working with the student at the bottom of the class. As long as they're willing to keep working, you know, mm-hmm. hard. To help kind of reshape their vision of themselves, you know, and try and help them find paths to success. I think there's a lot of great attributes to practicing law and a lot of different ways to practice law and to conceive of being a lawyer. And teaching law students to, you know, there's a whole range of ages, but a lot of law students are kind of in their mid-20s, mm-hmm. Early 30s, and so it's like this really... I don't know, like they're finding their professional identities for the first time or maybe the second time. so I find all that to just be really rewarding. And then on a more mundane level, I love the academic schedule. I like working really hard on one thing and then shifting gears entirely and then working really hard on something else in a predictable fashion. It just suits me. And with writing, academic writing is so wonderful because I'm not beholden to a client anymore. So I can truly go wherever it takes me, and I don't have to worry about that kind of whether there's someone's interest. It's, you know, that I might start to be contradicting.
Right. And if something crucial happens in your life, you can go down that path.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like with Sandy, I mean, I didn't think I was going to be writing about climate change. And then I've now 5 years of writing about climate change.
It's amazing. Well, so one of the things we talked about after your talk, just walking around campus, was that this law school is on an undergraduate campus, which isn't unique, but it's certainly unusual. And so we have a lot of undergraduates come through who are considering law school. We have them in and out of the building all the time. Just wondering what advice you might give to undergraduates that are considering law school.
Well, I would say you don't have to be a litigator. Being a litigator is great. I was a litigator, but if you're considering law school but you're not sure that that's really litigation is the career for you, there's lots of amazing things you can do with a law degree, like policy. There's a huge need for people to work with underserved populations. So it's a myth that the world has too many lawyers. There's a lot of need for legal services. I would say as long as they're, you know, you better have some passion because it's really hard work. That's not a myth. but it's rewarding hard work. So if you're not sure, then just ask around because there's lots of people who will want to talk about it. Lawyers and law professors and law students like to talk.
Anything in particular you think they ought to do to prepare?
I don't think there's like a book you ought to read or anything like that. I mean, there's great books that might be inspiring. I mean, you could read A Civil Action. That's kind of dated, but it's still a really good story. I think just enjoy time with your family. enjoy really relaxing, going to the movies and just being lazy time, because you're going to have to like buckle down. Yeah. I say that I just recently, a few years ago, became a mom, and people, my friends, I was late to join the Becoming a Parent team. And my friends said, watch movies, sleep in, and it's true, right?
Because
this will all end as soon as this little child comes into your life. And that's exactly true. Like, I never get any sleep and I never see any movies. Going to law school isn't as permanent.
That's true.
It's just, 3 years if you're on a full-time program. But I do think it's total commitment. Like, to really succeed at law school and at being a lawyer, you really have to commit. And I don't mean that to sound frightening.
Right.
I think, what's the point if you don't want to do it really well? Mm-hmm. And I ask my students on their first day, is anybody here because they want to be a mediocre lawyer?
That's a good question.
And no one raises their hand. And then I ask them, I ask them that a few times as we go throughout the semester, because some of them, don't always keep doing that, stellar work. And some of them have really good reasons. Their house is currently flooding.
Right.
Or their child's sick or whatever. But I do remind them, I remember you showed up here because you want to be a really good lawyer or advocate. So I do think maybe the best way to prepare for law school is to spend a little time enjoying yourself and then buckle down.
That's good advice. Well, in addition to buckling down, is there any other advice you'd have for current law students?
Yeah. So work very hard, but not ineffective work. Seek out guidance on how you can keep becoming more effective. Law schools are full of great resources. There's many faculty members and others who have sample answers and rubrics and who will give feedback on all sorts of things. And law students get busy or maybe for whatever reason don't always seek that out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to seek out those resources you know, so that you're not just working hard, but working hard and effectively.
Mm-hmm.
I also think don't define yourself by a failure. So you get one bad grade or one bad semester, seek out the resources again on how to work effectively and move forward. I've seen students go from being on academic probation to being in the A, you know, 4-point range.
Wow. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
For more information on Conversations with the Legal Academy, show notes, and additional episodes, go to law.uark.edu/podcast, or you can find us at kuaf.com under the local and podcast menu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe through iTunes or with your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, which will help others find us. Music for Conversations with the Legal Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. To keep up with us between episodes, follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.